Today's episode is brought to you by Summit Organizing Solutions, a Richmond, Virginia-based professional organizing business focusing on what's important to you. Because it's a crime to be a victim of clutter. Ha, see what I did there? Go to their website at www.sosvallc.com to check out pricing and before and after photos. All sessions include a consultation and in-person, hands-on personalized organizing. This goes beyond simply putting in shelves in a closet, and don't worry, they won't tell you to throw everything away. This is about the client's goals and what's important to them. Right now, SOS is offering a special deal to Crime Quest listeners with 10% off when you purchase a package of organizing sessions. Just mention the podcast when you schedule. And now, on with the show.
What do you think you're doing? You're listening to Crime Quest, a podcast covering the cold, the solved, and the theories. Join us. All right, hello. This is Kara and Amanda.
Hello.
Going to be our, what episode are we on? Oh my gosh.
11?
We're on episode 11.
Is it really? Okay. Yeah. It's been a while since we did the short one.
So we've stayed pretty consistent with one episode a month for a year.
Yeah. We're trying to work back up to more, but yeah, I think we're getting good with these once a month, but we'll try to get up to more, get some more minisodes released too.
Yeah.
So
we are talking about a couple of different murders today, but they're all allegedly linked together.
Okay.
The first one I want to talk about is something that happened in Richmond in North Chesterfield back in the late 90s.
Right.
It was involving a mother and a daughter, Cynthia and Heather Johnson. Cynthia Johnson was 34 and her young daughter, Heather, was 7 years old. They lived alone in the South Richmond neighborhood of Westlake Hills on West Junaluska Drive in a small brick rancher. Westlake Hills was and still is a very quiet suburban neighborhood in the Richmond, Virginia area and is not known for heavy crime.
Yeah, and that area is not technically Richmond. It's right on the border of the Chesterfield County in Richmond. So,
It's considered to be south side of Richmond because it's on the south side of the river, but it's a really nice area over there.
Yeah, and it's by the hospital, and I think that it's an older neighborhood. Are there so many older, pretty neighborhoods back there? They're very well established. They're very quiet and calm. And
I was looking at pictures of the neighborhood on Google, and it looks, the houses are kind of farther apart and big yards and little brick houses. So definitely not what you see today. The houses are a little smaller, but
in the suburbs.
Yeah. It's a well-established neighborhood.
Yeah.
So on Thursday, August 29th, 1996, Cynthia, the mom, wanted to order a pizza and did so. And they, she and her daughter settled in for the night. The pizza delivery guy would be the last person to speak to Cynthia Johnson, supposedly.
Oh.
Shortly after, firefighters responded to the home, only to discover it was also the scene of a homicide. So the firefighters obviously are responding to calls about a house fire.
Right.
The neighbors were the ones that called, not, not
so,
Cynthia.
Gotcha.
At least 7 fires were set in the home. This is after the firefighters were able to investigate. So 7 fires were set, which to me says, okay, this wasn't an accident.
No.
This is definitely intentional because I don't think 7 separate fires started at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to have a fire in a trash can or a fire from an electrical device and then immediately have one pop up somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, unless you've got Drew Barrymore from Firestarter living in your home.
Yeah, or you've left curling irons on in 8 different bathrooms. But
right.
I mean, that's obviously deliberate there.
And it was also discovered that Cynthia and her daughter did not die from smoke inhalation. They were actually found Cynthia's body was found in the family room near the carport, and Heather's was in the bedroom at the front of the home. Mm. But they were both, did not die from the fire. They were killed before that, and we were talking about it before we started recording. I wasn't able to find what their cause of death was, and I'm wondering if it was, they may have not known, because they, their bodies were probably burned, and maybe they weren't able to figure that out.
It depends. I wonder how long the fires were going before they were put out and the bodies were discovered, because it takes a long time to burn a body to a point that you can't get any kind of DNA evidence on it.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know how long. The way that the information is written that I was able to gather, the firefighters were called in the early morning hours, is what one article was saying. So let's say that the fire started at midnight.
Okay.
But I mean, if I was a neighbor, a fire would be, I don't know that a fire could be going for an hour without a neighbor seeing it.
Or smelling it. Yeah.
Like, I mean, and so.
Especially seven different fires in the house. That's going to burn quick.
And it makes me wonder if, not to be morbid, but if the bodies were actually set on fire and they were one of the seven things that were.
Yeah.
And if that's the case,
oh gosh,
like let's say that they were stabbed.
Yeah.
Because there is some reference later in an article about how one of the police officers believed it looked like some kind of ritualistic killing, and you had said earlier it could have been like a stabbing.
Yeah, carvings maybe.
And if that were the case, and they set the bodies on fire, then you may not see the evidence that somebody had been stabbed. But if you were to examine the bones, you should be able to see where there's some markings.
Right.
Depending on how it was done. But if they were strangled, like I hate to say that, like if they were strangled. Yeah,
that's, you should still be able to, I would think that there would be some sort of, like in the neck bones or the, I don't know. I was on a completely different, I mean, not a different subject, but something similar this last night. I was watching a documentary about the president of Poland's assassination back in, like, 1943.
Oh, okay.
And he was actually exhumed years later. It was a plane crash, but they were worried about him being assassinated. There's just a lot of weird stuff with the plane crash. Check out history if you like that stuff. It's a really good documentary. But it was, they exhumed the body years later to see if he had been strangled or stabbed or shot or anything, and they didn't find it. So I assume if they had that kind of technology back then a little bit, they should have it.
That's true. And I wasn't able to find a lot of information on anything more than what happened that night and what the police are asking for.
Okay.
And the main thing is they want to know who delivered that pizza to the house. And apparently nobody has come forward.
Really?
To say that they were the ones that delivered the pizza. And I want to know, okay, so let's say that, first of all, how do we know that the pizza was delivered?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what if somebody brought it over that stayed?
True.
And then,
shouldn't, what about, like, phone records and, or, I mean, they could have,
you know, maybe that's where they know that a pizza was delivered is because she called from the house. That's probably what it was.
And then if they, I mean, you would think if they went to the local place, the pizza places around there, there couldn't have been too many that delivered to that area. They should have been able to look through their receipts and find out who it was.
Well, apparently they can't. They haven't to figure it out. So,
okay.
And that's, I think, fairly recent. Like, I've been trying to find any information saying who delivered that pizza, and I wasn't able to find anything.
I wonder if they were afraid, maybe, to come forward?
It could be, but like I said, it's strange. Like, I feel like if I was the pizza delivery person and I knew that a family that I delivered pizza to that night had died in a fire, I would definitely want to come forward and say something.
Right.
It's just really interesting why somebody wouldn't come forward. It makes me think maybe the pizza wasn't even delivered. Like, maybe
Maybe
she went and picked it up and brought it home. Like, I know my parents did that a lot.
Yeah.
Back in the day, even when you could pay to have somebody.
Yeah.
You know, even when you could have it delivered, and they did it because they didn't want to tip.
Well, yeah, we did that on Friday because we were trying to avoid the delivery fees.
Yeah, we just didn't want to deal with it, so we would just go pick it up. So, like, what if she did call?
Yeah.
That's just really interesting.
But would she have... I don't know. I guess it depends on, like, what time it is. Because if you're... I don't know, if she's home and she's got the kid there and she don't want to get her all unsettled and have to go out again, maybe.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it could be. She had a 7-year-old daughter. I mean, you're a mom. Would it have been...
I hate going back out after we get
after
home.
After you've gotten home. Yeah.
I mean, luckily my husband goes out instead. But I mean, if it was just me and him, we would be home ordering delivery food. I would be having pizzas delivered.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, once you get them settled, if it's a, depending on the time of night, I mean, I don't know. I just don't like going back out after we get home and get settled in for the night.
So, I'm thinking that it probably really was somebody delivered it and they just can't figure out who it was.
I mean, I guess this was before, like, social media, so you couldn't, and, like, the tracking on the apps and stuff, so.
Oh, yeah, this was the late 90s.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been
I don't even think you could order pizza online then.
No. If you could, it was
you could order it through dial-up.
Only large pizza chains, like Pizza Hut or Domino's.
Yeah.
And I don't even know where they ordered the pizza from, which which I feel like if the police want the information, why are they not saying,
yeah,
oh, they ordered it from this pizza place, please let us know.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Maybe they knew something more. I don't know, but you'd think they would have released that if it's an unsolved.
Right, or why are they purposely leaving that out of of anything?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's something that, just with a little bit of digging, they should have been able to find the answer to.
Yeah. I mean, that would be the first thing I would do is, okay, so they had a pizza delivered. Where did they, where from? And if I couldn't figure out where from, I would go to every pizza place in a 10-mile radius and figure out if anything was delivered there.
I mean, there can't be that many pizza places in that area back then. I mean, maybe, like, the big chains and maybe even a... I don't even think the... Like, I only know of, like, one local chain that delivers, so...
Really?
Yeah, Vicelli's.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Like I don't...
Like, not a national...
Yeah, like, pizza you could go to, like, all the regular Domino's, Pizza Hut, Papa John's, whatever. But then, like, I only know of... like one or two in Chesterfield that deliver other than those. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like it would be a long list because you just find the ones that are in that delivery radius.
It's really interesting.
So.
So it's in what's in, so I'm going to, you know, aside from the whole pizza delivery thing, Cynthia was dating a guy named Glenn Haslam Barker right before she was murdered.
Okay.
And apparently she, I don't know how long she was dating him, but not very long, and then they had broken it off, and she was already seeing somebody else, and she and her daughter, Heather, went to Florida with her new boyfriend to go on, like, a little vacation, and then they came back, and that was, when they came back, right afterwards is when they were murdered, and they believe that Glenn Barker had something to do with the murder. And I'll get into why they think that later, but they have not really established a suspect other than her ex-boyfriend. So, also, they interviewed Barker, and he was shown photos of Cynthia and Heather's burned bodies from the fateful day, to which he showed no emotion. I mean, and I'm not saying that that's a sign of guilt.
No,
but like,
I mean, you've got to show some sort of emotion. Like,
well, and if he's so upset that somebody wasn't dating him anymore, then why is he not showing emotion?
Right. I mean, even if it's just like a, like, you're grossed out or like it's hard to look at or anything like that. I mean, even like some sort of emotion.
Right.
Sounds like it would be normal for that. Did they look into her new boyfriend at all?
They did not say.
Okay.
And it might be because he had an alibi, but I...
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm saying. Like, there's just not a whole lot on this.
Yeah.
Online. Also, Barker claimed that night that Cynthia and Heather died that Cynthia had invited him over and that he declined.
Hmm.
He admits he regrets that now because he could have stopped what had happened.
That seems like inserting yourself into the murder right there.
Yeah. Police were not able to prove that Barker was at the crime scene. And Barker has been the scapegoat for other homicides and even an abduction and killing in Charlottesville, Virginia, where he spent 9 years in prison, which half of the sentence was, which was half of his sentence. His original sentence was 18 years, and he served half of it because it was before Governor George Allen had abolished parole.
Oh.
So he was, the Barker was released from prison about 25 years ago. And he has maintained his innocence pretty much up until his death in 2014.
Okay.
But he says that he, you know, he's always maintained his innocence in the Johnson murders as well as the abduction in Charlottesville. The girl in Charlottesville, her name was Katie Worski.
Okay.
And that happened in July of 1982. However, he did admit to an assault of an 18-year-old woman in North Carolina in 1981. Oh, nice. So
he sounds like a peach.
He sounds great. he definitely had some issues. Apparently he came from a broken home as a child, which is not, doesn't mean that you're automatically have issues, but according to him, that was, you know, pretty devastating for him. I got the impression that he just didn't have a great upbringing.
Okay.
And then to top it off, he you know, he kind of had this interesting incident with this woman in North Carolina. So the woman in North Carolina, I want to talk about that.
Okay.
So Barker got a girl pregnant in high school. He was a football player, and I guess, you know, the quintessential story of the football player, you know, knocking up the cheerleader. I don't know if she was a cheerleader, but he did get her pregnant, and I don't know how old she was. I think maybe 16 or 17.
Okay.
And they ended up marrying, and I think they got a divorce, or they weren't dating, and they were married. And she left him at 8 when he was 22 years old.
Okay.
And he was pretty down about it and started using drugs and drinking a lot. So, an 18-year-old woman that he had known for about a year was coming out of church, and he followed her. He convinced her to let him into her car, and they drove around for about 20 minutes.
How low do you have to be to follow someone coming out of church?
I don't know. And I mean, it's like, well, they always say that some of the worst things, like a lot of assault on women is from somebody they know.
Yeah.
Because we're too scared to say,
oh, yeah,
to be mean or to
be
rude. So we will go along with it.
Yeah.
So he convinced her to let him into her car, and they drove around for about 20 minutes. And when the girl tried to drop him off at his house, Barker pulled a knife on her forced her into his bedroom, where he tied her up to the bedpost face down. He's really doing a good job.
Yeah.
And then he left the residence to move her car, which
at least he's thoughtful.
Makes me think, okay, well, you were moving her car because you were about to do something terrible. Not to say
that
what he was already doing was terrible, but he was about to do something really bad.
They weren't just going to talk.
No. And I don't think he was just going to, like, sexually assault her and let her go either.
That was going to be something.
Yeah, I mean, who does that? And then, so anyway, he then let the residents move her car. She was able to get free and escape through a window to a nearby friend's home.
Okay.
She
good.
Did go to the police. The woman declined to testify. Okay. I'm not sure why. And
probably
Barker,
fear.
Yeah. And Barker was convicted of assault on a female and received a 2-year suspended sentence.
Jeez. And when was this?
That was in the 80s. So, 1982.
So, yeah. I mean, women weren't exactly encouraged to, like, come forward to name their attackers at that point either.
Yeah. So after he began court-ordered mental health treatment at Dorothy Dix Hospital in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then Region 10 Community Service Board in Charlottesville, Virginia, to find out why I did that.
Okay.
Did this, is what he said. Quote, diagnosed with dependent personality and an adjustment disorder with depressed mood, one of the therapists at Region 10 suggested to Barker that his impulsive behavior might have been prompted by long-standing anger at women, and Barker did not appreciate this suggestion and ended his treatments after three sessions. So clearly that pushed a button for him when they were like, I actually think that you have a problem with women. And he's like, you know, totally not having that.
Yeah. And if it was court ordered, though, how was he allowed to end the treatment after three sessions? I guess he just did it.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess he did it and they just weren't enforcing it. He moved to Charlottesville because that's where his mother and stepfather lived. So this is after... So remember how I said he was in... So he was in Raleigh having... getting mental health counseling. And then, you know, I guess right after that, he decided to move to Charlottesville because his mom and stepdad lived there. And that's where he started going to Region 10.
Okay. And so can we step back for a second?
Yeah, sure.
What did you look up? I don't know what dependent personality is. I don't think I've heard of that one.
No, but you should totally look that up.
I'm going to look that up.
To me, like, just as a layperson who is not a psychologist, dependent personality would make me feel that somebody has to have someone else to depend on. And they do not, they have, like, a codependent nature.
That, yeah, it says it refers to a pervasive and excessive need to be taken care of, which leads to submissive and clinging behavior and fears of separation. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I just never heard... I mean, I guess I've never heard of that used as an actual diagnosis before. That's interesting. I wonder how common that is.
I don't know how common it is, but I've definitely met people that I thought were, like, borderline.
Yeah.
Dependent.
Yeah.
Super clingy.
It's about 0.6% of the general population. It's more often in females than males. Mm-hmm. But it's... due to behavioral differences in interviews and self-reporting rather than a difference in prevalence between the sexes. Mm. Okay. Interesting.
Which, you know, maybe his parents getting divorced when he was 6 years old is kind of what spawned that, but who knows?
Yeah. That's kind of interesting, though. And then adjustment syndrome is basically... symptoms that occur after a stressful event. So more like situational depression, I guess.
Okay, adjustment disorder.
Yeah.
Mood. So like maybe not dealing with something traumatic that happened.
Right.
Is that kind of what...
Okay. Yeah, it says after a series, after a stressful life event, you have symptoms such as stress, feeling sad or hopeless, and physical symptoms that occur. So that kind of sounds like just depression.
Yeah.
Like really, like situational depression is what I call it.
Yeah. Well, the article I got that from was saying that that's pretty much, you could say that about anybody that goes to counseling. Like, everybody has kind of an adjustment disorder with depressed mood when they go to counseling.
Yeah, exactly. But those don't even seem like violent disorders. That's the thing.
No.
Like, depression, I've dealt with clinical depression for a long, long time, and you don't have the energy to go hurt somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody else, but... yeah, I mean, I can't see, those just don't strike me as being violent tendency, or as having violent tendencies, so it doesn't, I wonder if they really did, he may have had those, but I wonder if they dug in and weren't finding anything else, or found anything else.
Yeah, I mean.
In his psyche.
I think it's just another, well, maybe not that, maybe not dependent personality disorder, but the fact that that one, clinician said that he had a long-standing anger at women.
Yeah.
You know, that's just another little piece of evidence that they would probably be able to use against him.
Yeah.
Also, in a New York Times article from 2002, I think I said this before, but he was cited as threatening the North Carolina woman with burning her house down.
Huh.
Which, you know.
Yeah.
Cynthia and Heather's house was burned down. I'm wondering if that was in any... similarity there.
Yeah.
The article was actually about Barker's town putting up flyers about him to warn people about his past.
I guess
I didn't even know you could do that.
I didn't either.
It was illegal, it was like a slander that you were allowed to.
That's what I thought. Well, I know with sex offenders now, there's that whole you can look them up in your neighborhood. I mean, I know it's not the same thing, but I wonder if it's similar. You're not really supposed to out anybody on the sex offender list, are you? I can't remember.
I don't know. I would think that, I mean, it's fine to tell people. But
yeah, I don't think you can use it for harassment.
Yeah, I don't think so, because it's harassment, which yeah. is illegal. You know, I think would be, like, kind of a misdemeanor. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But it's just, so here's a guy that clearly has some issues mm-hmm. and was pushed to abduct a girl that he knew and assault her and certainly terrify her.
Mm-hmm.
Or terrorize her, and then, you know, he's been in counseling, and in 1996, he's dating a woman that, whose house burns down after has already threatened that. So okay. it's kind of an interesting...
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm curious, though. He supposedly had this stuff from, like, his parents' divorce... But then he still moves to where his mother lives later. So obviously they still yeah. had some sort of a relationship.
Yeah, like, that's interesting too. Like, well, and it says that he has a stepfather, so I'm wondering if a lot of the issue was maybe with his own father.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
If you're blaming all this stuff on that sort of a relationship, why would you still have a relationship with the people that you're angry with?
Yeah.
To the point that you're following them to another town.
I hope that nobody can hear that.
Yeah, sorry. Apparently my neighbors are being very, it's a nice day outside, so they've got some really loud music going, so I apologize if you hear some bass. It's actually wouldn't be bad, but not yeah, if it's picked it's up by the microphones.
Soft. Yeah. You probably won't even be able to hear it, but, okay, so, Katie Worski is okay. the next, this is really what sends this man into... his life into a tailspin. So Katie Worski was a little girl. Well, she was like 12 years old, and she lived okay. in Charlottesville with her parents, Robin and Alan Worski. And on Sunday, July 11th, 1982, she begged her parents to let her stay the night with one of her best friends, 13-year-old Tammy Thomas, the daughter of single mother Carrie Gates.
Okay.
Katie's parents reluctantly drove her to 2745 McElroy Drive, the Gates residence. So, her parents had this feeling that they just yeah. didn't want her to go, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was an intuition or just random.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, was it hindsight's 2020.
Yeah. Was it the single mother thing, or was it just...
It could have been they just didn't want her to go.
Because I remember at that age, like, spending the night with my best friend, like, every weekend, almost. Yeah. One of us were either at their house or the other house. So I can't imagine, like... And it didn't... I mean, I had friends with single moms. It wasn't a big deal either way.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that was... it was just a weird feeling, yeah, or if...
I also remember my parents just... having days where it was like, no, we don't want you to go anywhere today. Like,
yeah, that's true.
Like, they weren't, my parents were not super strict, but yeah. if I was staying over at friends' houses a lot,
yeah,
and then I kept, you know, they would put their foot down sometimes and say, no, you should just stay, let's just stay home and spend time together.
Right.
And maybe that's all it was, is they were like, oh, you know, you're always over there.
Yeah.
Why don't you just stay home? And she's, you know, of course, cute little 12-year-old, and she's yeah. like, no, I don't, you know, I want to go over to my best friend's house, and they don't want to be, you know, they want to let their daughter have a good time. So
okay.
Unfortunately, at 5:30 a.m. the next morning on July 12th, the Worskis received a call from Gates, Carrie Gates, who was the mom of Tammy, asking if Katie was there, and she frantically explained that she had searched the entire home and believed that Katie might be playing a game.
Oh.
This is the worst phone call that yeah. anybody could ever get.
I know.
The Worskis insisted she call the police, and with no Katie in sight, by 7 a.m. the home was secured as a crime scene.
Wow. Well, at least they did it quickly. That's good.
It is.
There was no... Maybe she just walked home and...
But get this part, though. So before the police arrived, so she called at 5:30 a.m. The place was secured at 7 a.m. by... police as a crime scene.
Okay.
But before the police arrived, 23-year-old Barker.
Oh.
We remember him. Yeah. To help with the search.
Before the police
conveniently
arrived.
Conveniently, before the police arrived, which is very odd.
What the heck?
Alan Worski recalled immediately that he knew Barker from the Pantops gas station where Barker worked as a cashier. Huh. A side note, Pantops is an area in Charlottesville that is, it's not a city, it's just like a, it's not even really, I guess it's a shopping center.
Okay.
And everybody that is from Charlottesville or knows Charlottesville knows that this area of Charlottesville is called Pantops.
Okay.
So even though you may not be located in the Pantops shopping center, if you are anywhere close to that, you would tell someone, oh, I'm at the gas station okay. on Pantops. So gotcha. Everybody knows that that's, it's just kind of an area of Charlottesville. Yeah. Anyways.
Okay.
A little explanation there. Alan, so Barker worked at a gas station on Pantops as a cashier. And okay. Alan Worski, the dad of Katie, recalls Barker's reaction when he saw Alan as his eyes getting as big as silver dollars.
Oh, geez.
Like, kind of shocked that yeah. he knew him.
Yeah, that doesn't look suspicious at all.
Yeah, and that, so that prompted Alan to become extremely suspicious of Barker, which, hello, this guy shows up.
Yeah.
It had to be, like, 6:30 in the morning.
That's,
and
how
the guy the
hell...
is there. I mean, how weird is that?
Yeah.
So red flag.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like him trying to insert himself into the crime, and they've said that a lot of times the guilty people will try to make themselves part of the crime.
Yeah.
To feel like they're important.
Yeah, well, too, so that they can gather information.
Yeah.
So Barker had dated Carrie Yates previously, who was the mom of Tammy,
okay.
Thomas, and the two were still friends.
What?
Sounds familiar
how
to me.
Is, he's 23 and dating? How old is
he's
she?
He's 23. I don't know how old Carrie is.
Okay, then.
She could have been... So she... Let's say that... Well, she
well I
a,
guess she could have been in her
Carrie
late 20s, so that makes more sense.
Daughter.
She's late 20s, early 30s. I guess that's not too bad.
Yeah, she could be in... Yeah.
Guys do it all the time.
Yeah.
Date that young, so I guess it's no. It's not a big deal if women do it. Yeah.
So, the night of the 11th, Barker, this is just, I can't even, can you tell that I'm biased at all? I just feel like
that's okay. I'm
so guilty.
I don't know this anywhere near as well as you do, and
okay.
I'm already biased.
The night of the 11th, Barker reportedly came to the home with a six-pack of beer.
Awesome.
This is Carrie Gates's home. He gave the girls, a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old girl,
wow,
a beer. Although Tammy testified it was more than just one beer and said he tucked Eddie Thomas, Tammy's brother, and into bed that night and made sure the girls were peacefully sleeping on the
what?
Ground floor when he left around 12:30 a.m.
Where was the mom?
Good question.
Now I'm understanding why these parents may not have wanted her to go over there.
Good question. At the scene, Katie's belongings were still there. Well, so, okay, so let me back up for a second.
Okay.
So apparently Barker told police that Carrie had he had gone over there with a six pack to go see Carrie.
Okay.
And that Carrie said, I'm not in the mood to drink beer tonight.
So she let him give it to her
daughter. And then when he was
daughter.
About to leave, the girls begged him to stay.
Okay.
Because they wanted to talk to him. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I can understand that. Like, I remember being a little girl and, like, just
yeah.
my sister's friends came over. My sister's 11 years older than I am. When they would come over, I just, like, wanted to sit and talk to them forever because I thought they were the coolest people ever.
Yeah.
So I can kind of understand
but
the fascination, but I also think it's kind of weird.
If you're the mom in that situation, you
like,
put
no,
the brakes on that.
Yeah, I'd be like, you need to go home.
Yeah.
I'm watching these girls during their sleepover, and I'm not
yeah.
going to drink beer with you tonight.
I mean,
but
I wouldn't be leaving a 23-year-old man with violent tendencies in a room talking
well,
to my...
Right.
13-year-old.
She probably didn't know, but she also wasn't dating him anymore, which
yeah.
I found to be really interesting. So here we have a guy that we know, something is happening where he, like, again, we have no idea if he was involved in the Cynthia and Heather Johnson
right.
murder, but I feel like we have some indication here that when he's broken up with someone, he still contacts them.
Yeah.
Which I, you know... That's
maybe
something.
That's the adjustment or the dependent personality
yeah,
thing. You can't
still,
let go of that
can't
relationship.
Let go of the relationship. So at the scene, Katie's belongings were still there. At the crime scene, Katie's belongings were still there, which included her insulin.
Oh.
She was a type 1 diabetic.
Poor
and
baby.
Like her shoes. And I think she was last seen wearing a pink shirt. And
okay.
Katie had like light blonde long hair. And she was
okay.
about 12 years old. So yeah, she was a type 1 diabetic, so as you can imagine, they're missing a child.
Yeah.
And she also has a medical condition that has to be dealt with.
Yeah, if she was a runaway, she's not going to leave her diabetes or her insulin.
Exactly. The Charlottesville community rallied together to search for Katie, even searching when buzzards were seen circling an area. Yikes. I mean, they were on it. The nearby Rivanna River was also searched by divers, and dogs searched around the woods near the Gates' residence on McElroy Drive.
Wow.
Then, rumors began that Katie's body was placed under the Hardee's at Pantops in Charlottesville. Mm. They believed that her body was, like, in the foundation of the building.
Okay.
Which I've heard a lot of different murder stories where they think bodies were placed in foundations of homes or buildings when they're pouring the concrete to settle something.
Like, what's his, the mobster? Yeah.
They
Who's that dude? Oh, gosh.
The mobster.
They always joke about the
Whitey Bulger.
No, it was it'll come to me like after we're done recording. Okay. It was a dude they always swear was buried under like the football stadium in or Meadowlands Park up in New York.
Oh, I don't know.
I can't even remember. That's gonna drive me nuts.
Okay, you look it up.
Yeah, I'll look it up.
I'm gonna keep reading.
Yeah, please.
So anyway, that was just a rumor though. They never ended up like unearthing the Hardees to find.
Okay. So, real quick, like, there's downtown Charlottesville. Do we know where this was compared to, like, downtown? Just so I can get a sense of the area.
Okay, so it was Well, just look up McElroy Drive in Charlottesville.
Okay.
McElroy Drive.
Let's see. Jimmy Hoffa. Sorry.
Jimmy Hoffa.
That's it. Okay, now I feel better. Guy. Yeah. Okay. All right, sorry. That was driving me nuts.
You said mobster. Was he a mobster?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Or maybe he was a... Yeah, he was a mobster. Okay, wait. McElroy Drive. Let's see what we got here. I'm just curious, like, is this somewhere that she could have gone walking? Not that she would at 5 a.m., but, I mean, is this somewhere that... I cannot spell today.
I know what you're saying. Like,
is it an
area that she could have easily just walked off somewhere?
Yeah. Here we go, Charlottesville. So, it's actually right off of 64.
Can I see the map?
Yeah. Like, I don't know if that's near UVA.
Oh, I can tell you in a second.
So oh, good. Near... You know Charlottesville better than I do.
Yeah, it's right off of 5th Street, and it's in the suburb. Like, it's not near any... It's near Azalea Park. If anyone's from Charlottesville, they know exactly what I'm talking about. So, 5th Street runs through Charlottesville, and... I'm trying to think. Okay.
But it's right off the highway.
Yeah, so it's near Fry's Spring.
Okay, but it's not like
it's in
UVA campus type thing.
No, this is just residential. Like
okay,
a neighborhood. So yeah, it wouldn't have made sense at the time. I mean, I don't know what it looked like in the 80s.
I would assume more rural than
it could
even
been.
Now.
It could have been, but I think it was still like a little neighborhood.
Yeah.
But they. So they never said, like, they weren't ever able to find that she actually did leave the home willingly.
Okay.
The police, so in addition to them, like, hearing that rumor about the being in the Hardee's at Pantops, the police chief wanted to search the Ivy landfill.
Okay.
And he actually, I don't think they were able to do that search. They even went as far to hire Noreen Renier. Do you know who that is?
I've heard her name before.
So Noreen is a psychic detective.
Okay.
And she predicted that Katie's body was near a shed on a hillside in Albemarle County.
Okay. Didn't she have something to do with Mike, Margaret, and Donna
Renier? Hall? So they had a detective or a psychic hired as well, but I don't think
it wasn't
was
her.
Noreen.
Okay. Is she local or is she like national?
She lives in Free Union, Virginia.
Okay.
Or at least that's where her P.O. box is. I don't know if she actually lives there.
Okay.
I looked it up before we... Because I was curious.
Yeah, I'd like to see what else she's done.
What does a psychic detective's website look like?
Yeah.
It's mostly speaking engagement stuff and talking about her book and what she does.
Oh, cool. Maybe we need to look into interviewing her.
That would be amazing.
That would be fun.
Yeah, it would.
Okay. Show idea.
Show idea.
All right.
That was amazing. So, predicted that Katie's body was near a shed on a hillside in Albemarle County, and the mass searches were called off 4 days after her disappearance, with other small-scale searches still continuing.
Okay.
So, the large search where, like, the police were involved and they were getting everybody together, that stopped about 4 days after she went missing. It's, you know, it's extremely expensive for them to do these searches, and if they haven't found any evidence 4 days in...
And Albemarle's so, like, just expansive, and there's so many rural spots
of
it.
They were hiring, like, divers and stuff, and that is not cheap.
I think that
right now.
No, not at all.
So they did end up getting a warrant to search Barker's apartment.
Okay.
And they found... Get this. They found wet, blood-stained clothing and towels under his mattress and inside of a cooler.
That doesn't look guilty at all.
Not at all. Barker looked shocked when the items were found.
I'm sure he did.
Detective Bill Davis. Now, we all know that there are people that get falsely convicted
but...
they have evidence planted. But this just seems very, very odd to me.
Yeah.
This was before DNA testing also, so blood type was used to identify the evidence, meaning that when they found blood, they couldn't say, oh, this is definitely Amanda's blood, or this is definitely Karen's blood. They would just say, oh, it's type A or type B, or O positive, O negative, etc.
Right.
And so it matched Barker's blood type of A, of course, but at the time, they did not have Katie's blood type. Because it had never been typed.
You would think being diabetic, that would be something they'd have.
They did not have that.
So okay.
They couldn't determine if the blood found, which was type B, belonged to her. However, later, Katie's parents were able to get Katie's blood type tested because of some stains on her mattress and determined it was, in fact, type B. And so Katie, even though she was a type 1 diabetic, and I guess she gave her insulin shots in her buttocks.
Okay.
And they think that the stains on her bed were probably from that. She also had just started menstruating.
Oh,
so they think that it was, the stuff on her bed was definitely, like, from her.
Okay.
And it wasn't, like, from another family member or something.
Okay.
So
they eventually, when did they find out the blood type? How long was that?
I know it was before the trial.
Okay.
Which happened in early 1983.
Okay.
Or actually, like, mid-1883. Police also found a rolled-up pair of little girl's underwear in Barker's sock drawer with a tiny blood stain where Katie would have injected her insulin. Something they didn't find on the first search of his residence, which...
That
is really strange.
Yeah.
And I can understand if Barker is innocent... why he would be so outraged that they are planting evidence to make him look guilty. However, it's still really strange that he just shows up at a crime scene before the police even arrive.
Right. I mean, how do you even know?
But I do think that he lived nearby, so he could have seen what was going on, but it's like...
Yeah, but...
I don't know.
That just...
Strange.
But, I mean, the fact that the blood types matched eventually, that doesn't seem as circumstantial to me.
Yeah.
That seems pretty damning right there.
So, January 29th, 1983, there was enough circumstantial evidence to, you know, gathered to arrest Barker.
Okay.
And 6 months later, the trial began. So, we're talking June
of
1983. And Tammy Thomas testified that she and Katie had gotten ill from the beer that was given to them from Barker.
Oh, okay.
And there was, of course, evidence of type B blood stains near the downstairs coffee table, which could indicate a violence took place there. And the coffee table that was located in Tammy Thomas's house.
Okay.
They found that there was, like, some blood down there, and they think that maybe something had happened there, but they weren't able to figure out what. Tammy Thomas awoke at 5:30 a.m. from a bad dream and realized that Katie's bed was empty. Hair like Katie's was found in Barker's car, and dogs alerted to finding Katie's scent in his car as well. And then when asked if he harmed Katie, he said, "I probably did, but don't remember."
You would think that's something you'd remember, dude.
Well, also, like, if you're
innocent, you would say, why
would you say that?
Just say, "I didn't do it."
Barker maintained his innocence throughout the trial and says he was wrongfully convicted. Uh-huh. He walked free in April 30th, 1992 from Buckingham Correctional.
That is insane.
Yeah. So murder. He was only in jail for 9 years because,
like, that's ridiculous.
That was before George Allen enacted or got rid of parole for violent offenders. Jeez. In Virginia. So.
Okay, then.
So here we are. Like I said, that's why I was telling you before, like, I wanted to do this episode on Cynthia and Heather Johnson, but it was so much more than just their case. It really. So you start seeing this picture of this other guy that they think may have been involved.
I mean, how do you look at all of that? Looking at it separately, if it was just separate issues with him, I can see where it might look like you can make, or you can reason why things were the way they were. But looking at all of them together, I don't, that's just, there's too many little missing pieces, or little puzzle pieces that almost fit together.
Yeah. I felt that there was so much circumstantial evidence against Barker that I mean, I understand why he was convicted.
Yeah.
I
mean, I would have convicted him if I were on that jury.
It's so incredibly sad that they're just not able to find any evidence further on the Cynthia and Heather Johnson case in Richmond.
So they didn't even get to the point where they charged him with the murders.
No, so he was only convicted of the disappearance, and they didn't have a body.
Okay, so he wasn't charged with murder?
For Katie, yeah. So
so that's why he got out so early.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm guessing.
Because I would think kidnapping, well, kidnapping is going to have a lesser sentence than murder.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, and he ended up moving to New Jersey after he got out of prison, and he, like I said, he passed away in 2014.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yeah, he had a lot of health problems.
Yeah.
From what I understand, he had had a couple of strokes, a heart attack, and diabetes.
So okay.
He was, he had it all, and he did pass away. So, at this point, they don't, you know, if he's the one that really did murder.
Yeah.
Heather and her daughter, I mean, Cynthia and Heather, it's kind of.
Yeah. I wonder if they'd be able to get any kind of DNA off of them, off of their bodies now.
That's a good question. I don't know a lot about how long that stays around and, like, what they can get. I know that they cannot get DNA from hair, and usually your hair stays around. I mean, if you're in a, not to be weird, but, like, if you're in a coffin.
Yeah.
Also, though, they were burned, so they probably didn't have any hair on their body. It's usually, like, one of the first things that gets.
Yeah, but the bones should have.
The bones.
Identifying. I mean, I guess if you're trying to find the killer, you're not going to find his DNA there. You'll be able to find out or identify them, but. Huh. I mean, they had DNA evidence at this time. I guess there was. If it was burning, I guess there was no way to. I guess that kind of defeat. Or. Like, destroyed any DNA evidence that he may have left there?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's really strange. I mean, that's why, whoever did that to them, that's why they did it. Is because they knew that if they burned the house down, that it would cover up a lot of evidence.
Yeah. Huh. Because, I mean, the bodies aren't going to burn that fast, obviously. But.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a long time to burn a body.
I learned that recently from listening to Up and Banished, talking about the Tara Grinstead case. You can't just, like, light a body on fire and be like, okay, it's cremated.
Yeah.
You know, like, it takes a long time for it to go,
that's,
to burn up. It's really gross, but that's how it is. And I just think it's interesting that he was kind of involved with all of these women and bad things happened to them.
And very similar things that he talks about with them. Burning down their house and, you know, abduction and showing up places that he's not wanted.
Yep. That's just the fact that he showed up right after, like...
Yeah.
So he had been drinking, you know, at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, and then he's up and awake.
Or he never went to bed.
At 6:30 in the morning. Yeah, like, because he was probably doing something horrible with Katie, which is what I think, but... Ugh.
So, I know Tammy woke up at 5:30, but did they say whether... Did the police say whether or not they thought she'd gone missing before that, or if it was around that time? Maybe she woke up because she heard somebody moving around?
That is yet to be seen.
Okay.
I haven't seen where Tammy was able to say, or for them to have, like, a time when they think something happened, because they didn't have a body.
Yeah.
They know that the last time that they saw her was around midnight.
Okay. You know, so right, it could have been anywhere between.
It could have been any time between then. And what I think is weird is that Tammy had a bad dream that night.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
She had a bad dream.
Which is why I was wondering if maybe it was, like, a bad dream.
Was it a bad dream, or did you see something?
Yeah.
And you were just kind of out of it.
Or were you hearing things, and that was going into your... Because I'll have dreams where I'll hear things from outside, and it's made its way into my dreams.
Yeah.
So I wonder if maybe she was... If that was the case. But, I mean, if he showed up at, like, 6:30, what would he have done? He had to have killed her before then. If he was involved with the search.
Yeah.
So she had to have been gone earlier that evening, or after midnight, closer to midnight than 5:30.
I think that, I mean, a couple of things could have happened. Like, I think that he knows what happened to her.
Yeah.
The amount of circumstantial evidence and the fact that he said, yeah, I might have, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
When he was talking about hurting her. I just think that's really strange.
Yeah.
Who says
Why
that?
Why would you do that? Yeah.
Especially if you're trying to assert your innocence.
Yeah. And, I mean, he doesn't sound like he's... He doesn't sound incredibly smart, but he also doesn't sound incredibly dumb.
Yeah.
He's not... He doesn't seem like he's on either end of it. He seems like a normally intelligenced kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, would agree with that.
So, I mean, it's not like he's this mastermind... like, setting these things up, but it also sounds like he's not really thinking through his actions as far as showing up or, you know, telling the police that he was supposed to be there but wasn't. Why would you tell the police those kinds of things?
Yeah.
Why would you show up for the search? That just, I don't know. He seems like, I don't know, it almost seems like he wanted attention from it. And I don't know how true that is, but... Maybe that has to do with his adjustment disorder.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe he just likes attention.
Crazy. I'm looking at an article right now. There's another... there's something that happened in June of 1982, which would have been a month before Katie's disappearance in Harrisonburg, that they think Glenn Barker could have also been responsible for, but... it was the disappearance of Kelly Berg Dove. She worked at a gas station on South Main Street in Harrisonburg.
Okay.
Which was, like, a temporary stop for her in terms of, like, it was just a temporary job for her so that she could... She was 20 years old. She was the married mother of a 4-year-old daughter.
Oh, wow.
And she had finished high school a year early and was registered to attend Blue Ridge Community College in September. She had three sisters that also worked at the Imperial Station. And then at the time, the building sat by itself on, like, an isolated stretch of road about a mile south of JMU.
Okay.
James Madison
University.
JMU, because that's what everybody calls it. So on Thursday night, on June 17th, Dove agreed to trade with one of her sisters, like trade shifts.
Yeah.
And work the overnight shift.
Okay.
And so after midnight on June 18th, Dove called Harrisonburg police to report that a man driving a silver Ford had been harassing her. She explained she was working alone and implored, "Could you keep an eye on me?"
Okay.
In a second call, she reported the man had come in and had been dressed improperly.
Ooh.
She received a threatening phone call, and when she called police a third time, just before 2:30 a.m., she sounded panicked. "Please hurry," she said. "He's back."
Oh.
According to published accounts, police arrived at the station just 2 minutes after Dove's third call, but they found only her purse and a magazine
she'd
been reading undisturbed on the counter. Dove was gone.
Oh, no.
So, like, Katie Worski's parents, Fred and Rachel Berg, have lived for the past 25 years with the agony of not knowing what happened to their child. Jesus. Reached in Niceville, Florida, where the couple now live, and this article was
my friend lives there, sorry.
2000. This is kind of an older article from The Hook, which is, like, Style Weekly, but it's in Charlottesville. So, anyways, what was I saying? Niceville, Florida.
Yeah. On the panhandle.
When this article was written, that's where their parents were living.
Okay.
The couple now live in raising Dove's daughter, which is very
sad. Oh, that poor baby.
Rachel Berg says details of that night are etched in her mind. Police called sometimes after 3 a.m. and told her she needed to come to the station. Berg says she didn't learn Kelly was missing until she arrived, and she was bothered by the way police seemed to be handling the scene. They never closed the store, she says, never took fingerprints. She also doubts that they had arrived as soon as...
Yeah.
As soon after Kelly's call, as they claim.
Yeah, that sounds a little...
Harrison Berg did not return the Hook's repeated calls. Could Glenn Barker have been responsible for Kelly Dove's disappearance more than 70 miles from Charlottesville? In the months that followed, news reports claim that Barker, who sometimes drove a Ford, had been seen painting his car in the days after Kelly disappeared. Barker maintains that police ruled him out as a suspect in Dove's disappearance because he'd been at a family reunion where several relatives verified his presence, and the Bergs say they believe someone else was responsible, a man Kelly had known in school. He had a silver Ford, said Kelly's sister, Elaine Berg, declining to name the suspect. He'd been in trouble before with indecent exposure and phone calls, she says, but there was nothing concrete they could prove. Still, the Bergs say they wonder about Barker. One of Kelly Dove's friends traveled to Charlottesville every day of Barker's 1983 trial. She wanted to make sure it wasn't him, says Elaine Berg, who named her own daughter Kelly after her missing sister and remains close to Kelly's daughter Tammy, now 29 and a mother herself. Rachel Berg remembers Kelly, the middle of her five children, as a very strong person, a loving mother, and very independent. The pain of the loss and the continuing mystery remains close to the surface. Today is my birthday, Kelly's mother says during a recent interview, beginning to weep. We get by. You just always wonder how much pain she went through or what happened to her.
Oh, gosh.
I don't think they found her.
Doesn't sound like it.
And it says that it happened 3 weeks before Katie disappeared.
Wow. But the other thing, I mean, this guy, yeah, he doesn't seem super smart, doesn't seem super dumb. Where would he have put these bodies that police couldn't find them?
Yeah.
What in the world
and then it says was the he night doing with after them? Kelly Dove disappeared, so on June 19th, another young woman was finishing her evening shift at a Charlottesville restaurant, and her name was Paula Jean Chandler. She was 18. She had just graduated from high school at Albemarle High School, and she was working at El Cabrito's Mexican restaurant across Hydraulic Road in Charlottesville.
Okay.
And it sounds like, I don't want to read this whole thing, but yeah. It sounds like she went missing as well. The headlines about the case would soon be eclipsed by Katie Worski's disappearance. Chandler's murder ignited a firestorm. So it says she was murdered.
So they find her
body?
She had
water in her lungs, suggesting drowning. Oh, okay, they did. But she also suffered more ominous injuries, two head wounds from blunt trauma. The front page of the June 21st, 1982 Daily Progress featured a large photograph of a sheriff's deputy pulling on the arm of Chandler's corpse.
Ew.
Still partially submerged.
Oh, wow. My gosh. I wonder, I mean, this is a stretch, but I wonder if there'd be any similarities between Cynthia Johnson and her daughter's injuries and hers. If they say that she had... outward injuries. I wonder if there's...
there's all these.
Because that's the only time they have a body, though, right? The other two... I mean, we had Cynthia and Heather's bodies, but we didn't have Katie's...
Yeah, it looks like they found her in water. Hold on. I'm trying to see where they found Chandler. But, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Yeah.
It just seems way too coincidental that all those women would disappear at the same time. And Harrisonburg and Charlottesville are not that far apart. You could easily... They're all highway. It's all highway. So, I mean, 70 miles you could do in 3 hours. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine. I mean, and if he had a... She disappeared at 2:30 in the morning. If he had an alibi for that day, that doesn't mean he couldn't get out to Charlottesville by 2... Or out to Harrisonburg by 2:30. I'm not sure why that would have been dismissed as an option.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It looks like they did suspect Barker of that one, but they were also suspecting a cook that worked at the restaurant where Jean Chandler... Or Paula. What was her name? This is terrible.
Which one?
The girl that disappeared from the restaurant.
I can't remember what her name. I'm sorry.
I just said it, and now I can't.
Paula? Is that what you said? I think. I know Kelly was the one in Harrisonburg.
Chandler. Paula Jean Chandler.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of... So they think that he may have been responsible for some of those.
Okay.
I'm going to post this article in our show notes because it's so much here. But basically a lot of things...
Is that him? Sorry.
This, yeah.
He looks like, what's his name from The Office? Pam's ex.
Roy.
Yes, he looks kind of like Roy to me.
He does a little bit.
Like, he's got that, like, I don't know, he's just got that same, like, look.
Yeah,
like, he's kind of angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huh. And this is Katie.
Oh, she's cute.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. All right. Yeah, that's...
That's where we're at. I don't know if any of that stuff is going to get solved at this point.
I would imagine not.
But if anyone has any information, especially about the pizza delivery, the alleged delivery of the pizza to Cynthia and Heather's,
I feel like that's a missing link.
Yeah, call the Richmond City Crime Stoppers.
Yeah.
They're definitely waiting for some tips on that. Even on their website, they still have... You know, they want people to send them information. So if you were working at a pizza restaurant that was near Junaluska Drive in 1996, August of 1996, and remember delivering a pizza, please call.
Speak up, dude.
Speak up.
All right. Oh, well, wait, before we go on, just one quick question. Yeah. So if he moved to New Jersey after all of this, did anything ever happen in New Jersey that they tied him to?
Let me see. So they talk about that in this article, I think.
Because if you would, I mean, it stands to figure that he's not going to give up on this kind of stuff if he's like a sexual predator.
I don't think
they quit.
He did try to, in 1998, it was revealed that after volunteering at the YMCA, he had been hired part-time to coach a girls' basketball team.
Oh,
when police officers reported his history to YMCA officials, Barker was fired and all parents were notified.
Shouldn't you do a background check before you hire him?
Yeah, this was the 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they just didn't do that. But,
oh my gosh.
But that's kind of when all that started that I was telling you about earlier. They like put flyers out in the neighborhood to let people know that he was in the vicinity.
And okay.
There was a very dangerous
pain. Yeah. Honestly, I can't... I mean, I know it's probably not the greatest step to take, but I honestly can't really blame them for doing that.
It says that he was known to stop to help female motorists.
Oh, scouting?
Gosh. If he's not guilty, I don't even know.
Yeah, I mean, that just... Maybe if you look at everything separately, you could see him. Except for maybe Katie's case. I feel like Katie's case, he was... There was definitely... a crime committed by him there. But, I mean, if you look at them all separately, I could see maybe not seeing him as guilty.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at them all together, there's too many little common threads that run through them.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see how all of that is a coincidence.
No.
So, yeah. What a piece of work.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, I'm going to put all of this information in the show notes.
Cool.
And what's next?
Don't know. We will have another good case, though.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Well, you have a short you want to do.
Yeah, I'm going to put out a mini-sode. I'm going to start doing a mini-sode, a missing child series from the Richmond area, and just try to touch on some cold cases and some other missing, or, like, missing children from, like, the 80s and 90s, or even now that weren't found to be, like, a family.
Yeah. Awesome.
Kidnapping. So, yeah, I'm excited. I should have that ready in the next couple of days or so.
Okay.
I did want to give a plug for something that I've been listening to I am absolutely addicted to. It's Once Upon a Crime.
Okay.
I can't remember who the host is. I should have looked that up before I did that. But it's really good. She does these cases and she ties them together, and it's a lot of cases I've never heard of. But she'll do a series. Like, she just did one on killing, sort not Munchausen, but killing family members to get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating. Like, I was riveted to it.
Listen to that.
She's really good. She's very detailed.
I'm going to listen to that.
Yeah. So if you're listening, I really like you. Your podcast is awesome.
Yeah. I started listening to You Must Remember This.
Oh, I love that one.
And I'm reading the book The Girls right now. I don't know if you've read that.
No.
Yet. So it's based on the Charles Manson girls.
Oh.
But it's fiction. Ooh, so okay. All the names are different. And it's just written from the perspective of one of those girls.
Okay.
Being involved. And so, of course, I wanted to find out more about the Manson family and all that. So there is an awesome series of episodes about that in You Must Remember This. And I am totally...
Yeah.
It's like 10 episodes. She's good. It's very thorough.
Karina's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. And so that
has That's been easier to get through than Helter crazy. Skelter.
Yeah, my friend is like
I can't do Helter
that.
Skelter. I had it on an audiobook, and I always listen to audiobooks when I go to sleep.
Yeah.
And I woke up in the middle of that one. I'm like, I cannot do this anymore. I turned it off. I'm like, let's go back to history.
That whole thing is...
Well, one of them's up for parole now, too.
So Linda Van Houten got paroled, but they are waiting on...
Did the governor approve it?
So they're waiting on the governor to approve it.
Okay, good. He's not going to do it.
The parole board passed her.
I know. That was... My husband was telling me that.
He's not going to do it because Linda...
He refused it last time.
Yeah.
She needs to stay, and they all need to stay where they are.
Well, not only that, I kept thinking about, like, okay, these people have been in prison for years.
Yeah.
40 years. What are they going to do when they get out?
Yeah.
Like,
and it
really,
just...
like, who is, like, what are they going to do? How are they going to have a job? Like, all that stuff.
I'm sure they work with them, but even so, like, that crime was so horrible, I can't see.
Yeah.
I don't think any of them deserve to be paroled.
Yeah.
And I'm usually kind of more liberal on that kind of stuff, but those crimes were just so horrible.
They were so horrific that, they don't need to get out, in my opinion. But.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm pretty sure he's going to deny it, the governor.
And then I read about Charlie. Because everywhere I'm reading, people call him Charlie.
Yeah.
Charles Manson's wife, that 26-year-old girl.
Yeah. Are they still married?
I don't know. I just found the articles.
Oh, yeah.
Very awkward.
That's so creepy. I don't know how he was so mesmerizing. I guess
it's just like how
looking for
all
a savior.
These women like threw themselves at Richard Ramirez.
Yeah, that's true.
Richard Ramirez was oh god.
No. See, we talk about Richmond stuff, but we read everything. We listen to and read everything.
Well, the funny thing about Richard Ramirez is he was actually like if he didn't smile, he was pretty attractive. Like, he looked, had that, like, really angular face.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah.
But when he smiled, he had these, like, horrible teeth. And
That was the Night Stalker, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And apparently Madonna visited him in prison.
Why?
You know.
Whatever, Madonna.
People want to be close to controversy.
Yeah. Actually, the Night Stalker, the creepiest thing I ever heard, and I still can't listen to it without getting, like, freaked out, is on YouTube. There's actually a recording of the Night Stalker leaving messages on people's someone's answering machine, and there's this weird freaking picture that someone drew of him, of like just a I guess like a police
like
sketch
a
or
doodle.
Something. Yeah, and it is the creepiest thing I've ever seen in my life. It's always
later.
On like those top 10 craziest things that I watch, and
clickbait.
It was so, it just creeps me out every time. I'm like,
I'm totally
but then I have to go back and listen to it again.
Yeah.
I'm just like, what is
I
wrong
do
with
the
me?
Same thing.
Yeah.
I do the same thing.
Yeah. I'm creeped out, but I got to do it again.
About murder because we.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always fun too. I drive for Uber part time now, and I had people in the car last night, and we were talking about something in Richmond, and I told her that I had a true crime podcast, and we were joking. She's like, oh, I have to listen to it. So I've gotten like a few new listeners from there. So hi guys. it's fun. I'm surprised at how many people are into true crime when you talk to them out in public. I think everybody's just embarrassed to talk about it because you don't want to be the murder girl.
Yeah, I get Well, my spouse is always like, how do you, you know, you're staying up late reading all these murder articles. Yeah. And I won't watch shows like Game of Thrones or anything because I think it's too violent.
It is, but it's good.
It's just silly that I think that, but yet I'll read these horrible accounts of murders. But then he teases me for, like, feeding into the negativity, and I'm just like, you watch Game of Thrones.
Yeah, which is pretty horrible.
Which is so violent.
Yeah, well, Gus watches, like,
and he says it's different because it's not real.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well.
No, Gus watched Breaking Bad, and I couldn't get through that.
I couldn't either.
But he won't watch Game of Thrones with me.
I couldn't watch Breaking Bad. Because
he doesn't like the violence in Game. He watched it with me one time, and there was a scene in season 6, and I won't spoil it, but if you watched it, you know it. It just involved dogs.
Nope. Won't watch anything. Any violence to animals.
No. I was sitting watching it, and I had the blanket over my head screaming, and Gus was just yelling at me. He's like, why do you watch this? I'm like, it's because it's really good. He's like, look what they're doing.
Yeah, it's, I can't. Anything, any violence towards animals. Yeah. Like,
oh, that's what his problem is. He won't even be in the same room with me watching that.
Even if there's an inkling of it. Even if it's like, they show before it, and then they make the sound, I'll turn it off.
Yeah. Yeah, I just try to look away a lot.
Yeah.
So, all right, well that was a fun little chat
tangent,
at the end there.
But anyways, we'll be back soon. Amanda's going to do a short
missing child. Yeah, it's going to be a series, so expect one every week or two.
Okay.
So.
Word. Well, cool. Have a great rest of your day, everybody.
Have a good one, everyone. Listening. Thank you. Bye.
Crime Quest. It is our goal to make this as informative as possible. If you heard something amazing and want to give us a review, please do so on iTunes along with a rating. If you have suggestions for show topics, please send them to crimequestpod@gmail.com. Also, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Crime Quest Pod. Thanks. Crime Quest would like to give special thanks to Hemi Hames for putting together our music for this episode. Thanks, Hemi!